Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
Down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet. Not by chance. Don't cry, young.
Vocal trainer and award-winning composer Sally Morgan with us. She's the creator of and author of Sing Like You Speak, an innovator in the field of vocal training for the past 25 years now. Her clients appear on Broadway stage, major recording labels, national TV and radio, and in federal courts, and even in the U.S. Senate. And let's say, Sally, hi. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. How are you tonight?
Oh, I'm wonderful tonight. But I'll tell you what, they do sing some songs in the Senate, don't they?
They do. They improvise quite a lot, actually. Yes.
Now, I got how important is, and when I say is, voice training if you're going to be in public, even if you're not going to sing. You don't just get up and talk, do you?
No, absolutely not. It's essential for anyone, even in business, who trains other people, who does presentations. There's so much you can learn about your physical presence, for one thing, just walking in a room and people either immediately think that you're competent or they say, ooh, what's that guy going to do for us?
Yeah, I know, obviously, and there's no question about it. And I really believe it's that first couple of words that you say that the audience experiences. There's going to be something about, quote unquote, the presence of your voice.
Exactly. Exactly. Are you truly communicating? And that's what I always work with my clients on, because we all know people who can talk and not say a thing.
Oh, no question about it. As a matter of fact, when we really come down to it, vocal training, what got you into it? What was it that spurred you that said, this is mine, this is my light, and this is the way I'm going?
Well, I think I came out of the womb singing. So music has always been the top priority of my life. And I realized, I don't know, maybe 20 years ago, that my real gift was in teaching. That I came out of the womb singing. I've always had a great voice. But at the time, I wasn't a great singer. There's a difference. And I really worked very hard for a long time to figure out this singing thing, to make it simple for other people. And that is really my gift, is in training others to do it.
Okay, but when we say training others to do it, does everybody have the ability? Is it innate within all of us? It's just the mechanics, the strategy to get where you want to go.
I do believe that everybody can sing. It's what happens is that we are born with this great instrument. And the first thing we hear is, be quiet. So we begin to create a different way to communicate than the one that we are born with, because of the pressures within a family, within a society. And then it gets all mixed up. And the process of learning how to sing or how to speak is to get you back to that voice of your childhood. How did you use it? What muscles in your body were used to produce that sound? And get everything else out of the way.
Now, by the way, I've learned a lot about sound over the years, many, many years. The very interesting thing, will take me personally and will work with me and we'll see what we can do here.
Okay.
There was a time when I used to be able to imitate anybody and I could get my voice up high and then get it low. Then I had a physical problem. I had an operation. It took a lung out, actually. And when they did that, I'm still in great physical condition, but when they did it, it changed my voice. Now, I sound like I've always sounded all my life, but every once in a while, I'll be talking and I'll run out of wind. Or if I'm singing and I love to sing, I will start to hit a high note and the voice will go. So is there any way to control not only the volume, but the tone?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. The way I teach, as far as, we'll talk about volume first. If you are singing like you speak, it is the emotional content of your voice that is going to dictate the volume. If I say to you, hey, cut that out.
I say, yes, Mom.
Yeah, right. Or I say, hey, I'll give you 2 hours to cut that out.
Yeah.
Those are two very different things.
Sure.
And my emotion is different, and therefore my voice responds differently. So you have to give your person the credit of being this brilliant instrument. It's brilliant. And so coming from what is your emotional content, and not just, geez, I really want to nail this note and wow the crowd. That never wows the crowd. It always comes out as something that's harsh and pushed.
Sinatra was like you were talking about, wasn't he? Because when you deal with Sinatra, he didn't have a voice. He had an instrument, didn't he?
Oh, my gosh, yes. Yeah. And as laid back as he may have seemed at times, he cut his teeth singing with big bands. And he would stand behind the band and watch the horn players breathe. And that's how he learned how to breathe. It's how he learned his phrasing, was by listening to the masters of the horns or clarinet or whatever the instruments were. He learned that way, and he worked at it. Nobody does this without really working at it.
No, but the length of his breath was unbelievable.
Yes. Yeah, and you did ask me about that, about using the breath. There are certainly ways for you. What you want is to use the breath efficiently. You are minus a lung. There's no way we can give you back another lung. But what we can do is to help you use that breath very efficiently.
Okay, now, by efficiently means what? Now, I may be talking. I do a lot of, you know, public speaking and whatever, and I'll be rolling along, and every once in a while, I'll run out of breath, and I'll catch it real quick because I've been doing it for so long now. It's been 14 years, so I'm very used to it, and then I'll know when I need to get my voice a little lower. There's a couple of things I'll do to get it low, so it is a complete strategy, I know, with voice. I am no expert by any way, shape, or form, but I do know that it's all strategy, it's all technique.
Yes, yes. Well, I wouldn't say strategy. I would say process of technique.
Okay.
What is the process by how do you inhale? How do you create the sound? Where you let breath flow through your body is really important. May I work with you for a moment? Would that
sure,
be okay?
Go ahead. Okay, oh. I'm here. I'm yours.
Okay. So what I'm hearing in your speaking voice is a lot of pressure from underneath the larynx, a lot of pressure in the throat. So what I would like to do with you is to help take away that pressure. And instead of using muscles in the throat, which are never going to help you produce a good sound, use your belly muscles, your lowest abdominal muscles. So why don't you just say, what do you say when you first come on the air?
Welcome back. This is Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
Okay, great, great. So we're going to use that phrase. But what I want you to do first is, are you sitting up straight, my dear?
No.
Okay. That's first.
Busted.
Yeah. I could tell that you weren't sitting up straight. That's why I asked.
Yeah.
Your body's the instrument. You would never attempt to play a guitar with a bent neck, would you?
No.
Absolutely not. So it's the same with your body. So, as your mommy said, sit up straight.
I'm up.
Okay. broaden your collarbones, get your head on top of your body. Okay. And what I want you to do for your inhale is to soften your lowest abdominal muscles and lowest back muscles. Just soften those muscles.
Got it.
Okay, great. Now, after you soften those muscles, I want you to say your opening phrase again.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
I heard a much different tone quality.
I can, but the dogs think so too. No, I did too. I heard it.
Okay. So what we did was we straightened out your posture and we gave you an inhale that accessed the muscles that you need to use to produce sound.
Ah, got it.
Got the right muscles working. Okay, now we're going to do one more thing with you.
I'm ready.
Same thing, nice and straight. Drop the breath down into the body. And as you do so, I want you to really drop your jaw. Really open your mouth so you're going to catch some flies and then begin your phrase.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
Whoa. Better again. Right?
Yeah, I'm listening to it. And I know actually, and I think I need a little more energy in that. I had to get up at 5 o'clock this morning to take my sister to a eye operation. So it's been one of those days. So let me get the energy going and we'll rock. Cause my life is built around energy.
Right. Right. But you see, if you can't push energy, you cannot push it by asking you to drop the breath way down into your body. You're dropping down into your power center, which is also where all that wonderful energy and your creative spirit comes from. You will get that energy just by breathing differently.
All right, let me try it again. Okay.
Okay.
Here we go. Vocal trainer and award-winning composer Sally Morgan is the creator and the author of Sing Like You Speak.
Okay, good, good. Now, if we want to add even more energy, you want to play your consonants a little bit.
Example. You know what I mean?
Okay, so award-winning composer and vocal trainer, you got a great V there, vocal trainer, Sally Morgan. Play your consonants, because the consonants are the action of our words. Play the consonants and you'll have a lot more energy in what you say.
Vocal trainer, award-winning composer, Sally Morgan is the creator and the author of Sing Like You Speak.
Yeah, yeah.
Huh? I could be a talk show host.
You forgot to drop the breath down in your body.
Oh, sorry. I need notes to do that. That's going to be practice.
It does take practice, but it's so worth it.
Oh, I totally agree.
Yeah, and even for folks who are not announcers on the radio, it's our way of connecting with people.
No question about it, and it's in the emphasis, it's in the pausing, and it's in all those things. Now I'm thinking about get your stomach out there, get your back up, drop your jaw. Okay, I got you. I'm serious. All those things are going through my mind as I'm speaking.
Great. Well, that's good. And once you practice it enough, then it becomes a habit. And it's right there every time you need it.
Okay. Now, the voice lessons in effect, when you're working with somebody, and I'm not going to ask you how long it takes because everybody is so absolutely different when they learn. But what is the process? You start that with someone, do you work with breathing, enunciation? How does it work? And then how do you build them to singing?
Oh, okay. That's a great question. I always begin with what is this instrument, so that we know we have the same terminology about the pieces of the instrument and how they function physiologically. Because again, this is a perfect instrument, and we don't want to use anything but what's available to us in the vocal system. So we get that. And then I take them to breathing. I take them to what I call the candle exercise. And the candle exercise is all about diaphragmatic breathing, but without thinking about diaphragmatic breathing. And so we can do a little if you'd like.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm right here.
Okay.
That's what I said. I'm all yours. By the way, you look like you sound.
Oh, I do?
I have your picture right here. Yeah, you look like you sound. Or you sound like you look.
Well, I hope that's good.
it's a good thing. It's a good
okay.
thing.
Okay,
yeah, and I don't know how, you know, for 23, 24-year-old, you had all this experience training.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
So, was that good?
That's fabulous. Thank you. You're now my favorite person.
I got it.
Okay. All right, so the candle exercise is you just stick your thumb up. That becomes your candle. You're going to place the candle heart, about the same heart height, and 6 or 8 inches from your body, and just blow that candle out with 3 blasts of breath. Just try that.
I did.
Okay.
I shut the mic off. Yeah, but now I did.
Right. And each time in between blowing out the breath, since you know how to do it, you're going to soften those lowest belly muscles.
Uh-huh.
There you go.
Just turns in now. That turns onto the show right now. Be very strange.
that's going to be ruined here.
Go ahead.
All right. Now, let's add an SH. We're going to blow the candle out with an SH. All right. Okay. Listen to mine.
Okay.
Yes. Now, really blow the candle out. Good. And this would be the process of making the breath efficient.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Now, we're going to do a whole word. Shopping.
Shopping.
Yeah. Now, you helped from your throat when you said the whole word.
Okay.
You do not need to do that. The SH is moving along the right path through your body. Let the rest of the word follow that path. Go ahead.
Shopping.
And you're still helping out a little bit.
Oh, I'm stuck in the throat.
Okay. That's okay. We're going to do something different. When you say an F, you'll feel that F moving through a high place that's really kind of behind your nose.
Yeah, yes.
All right. For you, that is perfect because it'll get you out of your throat. So let's say fantastic.
Fantastic.
Aha. Very good. Very good. Now, in between those, you're going to drop the breath way down in your belly. Try it again.
I lost the breath.
That's okay.
Wait, somebody get oxygen. I'm going to get off. I'll get off the- I did. No, I got it. That's that. I get caught in the fantastic. I can't get it back up fast enough.
Yeah. Okay. See, that's the whole point. F is moving very lightly through your head. It has nothing to do with the throat muscles. And then you go to say the rest of the word and you're gripping in your throat.
Oh, okay. So I'm getting caught in my throat.
Yes. Yes. So that's the whole point of the exercise then, would be to help you find that higher space to use a different path for the breath and sound to follow, so you're not straining in your throat. This will increase your volume, your resonance, and also the efficiency of the breath.
You know, it was interesting because I'm working with someone now who has a very, very strong Russian accent. And if I listen to her very closely, what I hear, it's coming from way down. It's coming from the back of the voice instead of the back of the mouth instead of the front of the mouth. And I know that's probably hard to explain, but I can hear the difference.
Right. I understand perfectly what you're saying.
Yeah.
But yeah, different languages are produced in different places. I would still work with someone like that to find a higher release.
Yeah.
Meaning through this F space.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm going to tell her to come talk to you.
Great. Great.
Yes. Yeah. She likes this guy. She likes him. She talks the book. You know, and there's a lot of people who may not understand that.
Yes.
All right. We're starting to run out of time. I think this has been wonderful, and I'm going to go practice and everything, and I've got to get the book and do some stuff here. Now you got me thinking. I've had this voice for, we won't tell anybody how many years.
Okay.
Okay. Well, maybe we will. Okay. But anyways, I have this voice for lots and lots and lots of years, and it's interesting because every once in a while, I'll hear somebody like yourself and say, okay, there's another level that it can go to. Because I really believe in my heart of hearts, if you're going to do anything public, or if you're going to, I'm going to use the word impress, I don't like the word, but if you impress somebody, you're judged a lot by your voice.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, no question about it. Sally, where can we find you? Website?
You can find me at singlikeyouspeak.com.
Wonderful. Well, can we buy the book there?
You can buy the book there. SingLikeYouSpeak.com is a membership website with video voice lessons and a practice guide, video of me working with private students. It's really comprehensive. And for singers or speakers who are looking to train their voice, it's the way to go.
Okay, I'm going to tell you how old I am, but you got to promise not to tell anybody.
Okay. You got it.
It's our secret. I just turned 69.
No.
Yeah.
Wow. Good for you, man.
Yeah. There's a long way to go. Hey, listen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Good night.
Good night.
No there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Build those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk. Where are we? Dresser After Dark. I know. You get a little older, you forget this stuff. Jacqueline Whitmore with us. She's the author of Poised for Success, Mastering the Four Qualities that Distinguish Outstanding Professionals. She's an etiquette expert and the founder of the Protocol School of Palm Beach. Her clients include the U.S. Department of Defense, Booz Allen Hamilton, American Heart Association, Deloitte, Ernst & Young, and the list goes on. And let us say, Jacqueline, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Michael.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. Etiquette. You know, when we hear that word, we hear it bannered about, but there's so much power behind it. It's so subtle that most people don't even realize there's a process behind etiquette, do they?
No, etiquette is not what you think it is. It used to be considered stuffy, but now it is a most essential business tool, and I work with a lot of executives around the world teaching them how to polish their personal brand, because I believe that we're basically like diamonds in the rough. We just need a little polish every now and then.
Now, by the way, once you meet somebody for the first time and then you meet them again and then you meet them again, there is a difference between the interaction, isn't there?
Yes, and research shows that we make the first impression lasts 5 to 7 seconds. In other words, the first 5 to 7 seconds of meeting someone is the most critical, and people evaluate us on the way we speak, on the way we dress, on the way we shake hands, our eye contact, how we maneuver a knife and fork, and everything in between, because we are a visually oriented society, let's face it. So it's great to have that first impression, a good first impression.
Now, and by the way, when you're meeting somebody for the first time, obviously there's handshakes. You don't want to break somebody's hand and make them fall down to the ground. And then again, too, you don't want to be so limp that there's nothing behind the handshake. Well, let's say you and I meet for the first time. We're introduced. What's the proper way of us connecting with each other?
Well, the most universal way is with a firm handshake, but handshakes can also be cultural. For example, if you come to Palm Beach, where I live, you might even get an air kiss, and that's quite common. Or if we go to another country, you might get a kiss on the cheek. But the most universal greeting today among men and women is the firm handshake. Now, there are also different types of handshakes, like you mentioned. For example, the wet fish, the cold, wet, clammy fish, which it turns everybody off. Or you might have the fingertip holder, where someone just offers their fingertips. Or worse, you might have the Terminator. I also call that the bone-crushing handshake, yeah. And that's someone who wants you to know he or she is in control. And then finally, there is the person who likes to give you that warm, loving, consoling two-handed handshake. I call that the rubber glover.
Now, is that
those can send the wrong signals, Michael.
I was going to say, well, is that a good thing or a bad thing? But I think you just answered that. Yeah, they're very interesting because years ago, you meet somebody for the first time. What was acceptable 10, 15, 20 years ago is completely non-acceptable today. And as a matter of fact, I think the book and the training that you do has got to be the window of opportunity is here, because there are so many people for that first impression that give the wrong impression because they've done something that's sincere from their heart, but culturally it's not accepted anymore, and the disaster strikes.
Right. Well, there are so many different mistakes that we can make in business and in social situations these days. People don't know whether to kiss, bow, or shake hands, and that's where I come in. That's when I usually get a phone call from a corporation, and they say, please help. One of our executives has just made a huge faux pas. And it might not seem like a huge faux pas to this person at the time, but it really is, and you would be surprised that I've gotten calls from CEOs who have said to me, you need to come in and train our staff because we have so many people who dunk their bread in their soup. And that may seem like a minor infraction to most people, but when you're operating on a very high level in corporate America, I mean, it can be a career breaker. And even if you're on a first date, let's say you aren't in the business world, and you're just on a first date and you see someone dipping their bread in their soup or talking down to the server, that's a really that's a big faux pas in my book, because you can
sure.
oftentimes tell a lot about a person by the way he or she treats someone who's serving him.
Very interesting. I want to go to back to shaking hands and some of the things that you talk about. Men can initiate a handshake in business, but in social situations, a man should wait for a woman to initiate the handshake.
Right. Well, in the business arena, it should be gender neutral. So in the old days, men were always taught to wait until a woman extends her hand first. And that's fine if you're in a social situation, but in business, men should not wait. They should extend their hand first, because that person establishes the control and the confidence when he or she does that. So it doesn't matter who extends the hand first. That's really important. And also, I say that it's important to stand up when you meet someone. Get out of the chair. When someone walks up and approaches you, standing shows respect for yourself, and it also shows respect for the other person, and that's the missing piece. Most people know how to shake hands, but they forget to stand up.
Yeah, by the way, I think that's a very important point, that if you do meet somebody for the first time and you shake hands and they sit there, it's almost an insult. It's they don't want to take that extra step, quote unquote, to stand up, meet you at your level, and shake hands and be introduced. And it's the sitting down. It's almost a looking down at you.
Yes, that's exactly right. And the other person is in control. And the other point I'd like to make is it's important to smile and make that eye contact. The handshake, yes, that's very important too. But complete the interaction with a smile, because the smile is the most beautiful curve on the human body. And that eye contact shows the sincerity, the interest in the other person.
You know, I've said to people for years, and this is going back way, way, way back, that there are people who are uncomfortable looking someone in the eyes. And it happens, and we know it's there. And I've said for years, if you're really uncomfortable looking at someone directly in the eyes the first time you meet, look at the end of their nose, because the other person, it looks like you're looking in their eyes. But there are a lot of people who are just uncomfortable with eye contact.
Yes, that's true. And I like your tip about looking at the tip of the nose. I had never thought about that. I'll have to use that in my seminars.
It's yours.
That's a really good tip. But yes, eye contact can be cultural. For example, I was teaching a group of students from India, and they barely looked me in the eye. And I asked them, why don't you look me in the eye? And one of them said, because in our culture, it's a sign of respect if we don't stare in the eye. So you have to consider cultural differences.
Oh, by the way, when you're dealing with cultural differences from country to country to country, what did you say before? You know, it's a handshake. It's a what? You used three words.
You said, yes, the handshake is the universal greeting.
But you said there was three things that you said. Whether it was a handshake, a this or that, it's the bow, the whatever. It is based on where you are. What might be insulting here would be absolute respect someplace else. So it's always good to know where you are and what's acceptable before you get there.
Well, it's doing your homework. And I always say to people whenever they go abroad, and also if they have a meeting with someone here, even in the States, to remember the P's, the four P's. Prior planning prevents poor performance. Five P's.
Don't ask me
it's
to
been
say
a long day.
Wait, don't ask me to say that 10 times consecutively. I'd be in trouble.
Right.
No, but absolutely. So I really believe that what you're saying can make or break a business negotiation. Because what happens in front in that, you know, that first 8 to 10 seconds, you can't have a second first impression. I mean, there is no way to do it. So if you know ahead of time who you're dealing with and those people that you're dealing with, and if you do it in the way that they've learned how to do it and what's acceptable and what's respectful, then you're way ahead of the game.
Right. Well, etiquette really is just being mindful of others. It's having your antennas up at all times and just being aware of your surroundings and treating others the way that you would like to be treated. That's really what it is. It's respect for other people.
There's no question about it. Now, when you first got into this, what was it that caused you to notice there were these great differences? And they are great differences.
I've always been inquisitive. In fact, I went to college to become a broadcast journalist, and I thought I wanted to be a reporter, but I didn't necessarily go that path. In fact, I graduated from the University of Florida with my degree in broadcasting, and I decided to work in the hospitality industry. So I took a completely different career path. But I've always been inquisitive. I've always liked to ask questions and know the why. For example, when I learned about handshaking, I know how to shake hands, but why do you shake hands that way? Why do we look someone in the eye like that? Why do you stand like this? Why do you hold the knife and fork like this? So I was always interested in learning the history behind behavior and why we do what we do. And so that's why etiquette intrigued me, because etiquette goes back for hundreds of years. In fact, George Washington wrote what is considered one of the very first etiquette books, and it's called Rules of Civility. And he wrote it when he was just 14 years old, and it's still available. If you go online, you can find it, and it's just amazing. Some of the principles that he talks about in his book still apply today.
I think what it brings it down to is the difference between accidental or intentional results. If you know what you're doing, you know why you're there, and you're intentional, your results come out so much better. And if you walk in accidentally, quote unquote, most of the time you don't get what you want. And when you walk away and you're a little bit feeling bad about it, a little bit feeling bad about it. Then Radio Susie just fell off her chair and said, did you really say that? When you're not feeling good about it and you don't know why, it's because you weren't intentional with what you did.
That's right. And that goes back to the five P's. The prior planning prevents poor performance. And when you're not prepared, when you don't do your homework, then you're going to miss out on a lot of opportunities. I just had a party at my house recently to celebrate my book launch, and I was watching the different people who were coming in and out, and I noticed that some people congregate with people they only know very well. And then you've got other people who are there because they know they were invited for a reason. So they're networking, they're speaking to people, they're shaking hands, they're great conversationalists. And that's what we like to see. And that's what I strive to do whenever I go to these events, is to reach out and meet people, because you never know who that next person will become in your life. It could be your new best friend. It could be a new client. It could be even a love interest. You never know. The opportunities are endless.
And you know what brings you to those five P's?
What's that?
The four P's, the polish, presence, professionalism, and passion.
Oh, that's right. And I write about that in Poise for Success, because I think that the most successful executives who I have met have those four P's, and they're so very important, especially the presence and the professionalism. And, of course, all of them are important, but the presence, the way you carry yourself, you know, there is a difference between getting dressed and putting on clothes. Anyone can put on clothes, but getting dressed requires thought. It requires preparation. In fact, I just went to an event tonight, and I had to think about, what am I going to wear? Because I want to make a good first impression, because you never know who you might meet at these events.
True, true. Now, we're starting to run out of time. Jacqueline, let me ask you this. Is there a website we can find you at and get the book?
There is. The book is available at all bookstores, but if people want to learn more about me or the book, they can visit my website, which is etiquetteexpert.com. And I also have a blog that is jacquelinewhitmore.com.
Wonderful. Hey, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated the time. And I really believe in today's world, especially, you learn your etiquette. And if you do that, you'll get most of what you want.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Michael. It's been my pleasure.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
And a love who's burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore, that's all.
That's all.
I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
Dream lover, where are you?
Tammy DeVille with us. She's the author of Changing the World on a Tuesday Night. She's listed in the top 10 in the volunteer category to follow on Twitter. The author, again, of Changing the World on a Tuesday Night. Tammy's extensively researched opportunities for volunteering that don't take up much of a person's time. She's been a guest on a number of talk shows, including the Philadelphia Agenda with Brad Siegel and the Donna Sebo Show. And let us say, Tammy, hi, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Michael. It's great to be with you.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. How many times have you been on Donna's show?
Just once.
Oh, okay. No, she's great. I used to interview Donna all the time years ago before she had her own show. And, you know, she's a psychic. And it would be great because she'd come into town and I'd just sit back and I'd say, it's Donna Sebo. And I'd sit there for 2 hours and I wouldn't have to say anything and I had the greatest time.
That's great.
People call up and do stuff. Volunteering. Isn't that kind of an interesting thing? There's so many people who would love to, but it's quote unquote too much time, haven't got the energy, haven't got the money, haven't got the something. And I think so many people miss an opportunity to build themselves by volunteering, because when you volunteer, it's not necessarily that you're giving, you get so much more out of it.
That's exactly right. And you touched on half of the reason that I wrote the book. I would talk to people about my volunteering adventures, as I like to call them, and I would get one of two responses back. They would say exactly what you said. They really want to. Deep down, they really do want to be doing something in their community and in the world. But as you mentioned, they feel like they're just too busy. There's not enough time. And then the second thing that came up just as frequently was they didn't know what to do, and they didn't know where to even begin looking for opportunities.
Yeah. Now, by the way, you've got something right here in your press release that I think is absolutely phenomenal. I would have never thought about this. So how you're able to mentor children in Africa by using your computer, your webcam.
Yes.
Who would think about that? Who would think about that?
Yeah. It's an amazing organization called Infinite Family. They're based in Pittsburgh, and they match mentors all over the world with children in sub-Saharan Africa. Many of them are AIDS orphans, so they're in communities where there are not enough adults. So they are starving for adult time and one-on-one interaction with adults and mentorship. So through the power of technology, with a laptop and a webcam, you can get connected with one of these kids. So I began, as I was researching the book, I fell in love with the organization. So I began mentoring with them as well. So on Monday mornings from 8 o'clock to 8:30 every Monday morning, I talk to a 13-year-old boy named Clarence who lives near Johannesburg, South Africa.
Now, by the way, who is this organization?
The name of that organization is Infinite Family, and they are profiled in my book.
Oh, wonderful. I know. I think it's an absolutely wonderful idea. And then one of the other things you talk about that it's so subtle that most people don't think about, the media. You know, they talk about all these celebrities that volunteered a million here and a billion there, and they went over here and they did that. And the average person sits back and says, well, that's all well and good, but I can't compete with that.
Exactly. I have a mortgage to pay. I have to go to work in the morning. So a lot of times people think, well, when I'm rich, right, if I was rich or famous, of course I would volunteer all the time. I would give a lot of money. Or perhaps when I'm retired, you know, or if I was just, you know, wealthy housewife, surely I would have plenty of time on my hands. So people think that just a certain segment of the population can really afford to give up their time. And in actuality, we all have extra time. We all have a little bit of time. And as you mentioned, media doesn't help with those stereotypical beliefs, because the media covers two types of stories significantly. One is celebrities who are making a difference in the world. The other is ordinary people who do really big projects. You know, there's a beautiful little girl in Pennsylvania who had cancer, and she did a lemonade stand in her front yard and ended up raising millions of dollars through the campaign. She had a beautiful, amazing story. There's a gentleman who quit his job, and he moved to Africa to build water wells for populations down there. Again, awesome, incredible work. But when the average American who's working full-time hears those stories, they're left inspired, but they're not left related or connected to that kind of opportunity at all, because it just is too much. It's too big. We don't hear enough of just the little stories, the people that are just making a small impact every week for weeks on end in their communities. And I think those are the stories we need to tell more often, so people understand what it takes and how they can get involved with just a little bit of time.
Well, here's the key, your simple message. In the same amount of time you spend on Facebook, you could quite literally be changing the world by volunteering, using your hobbies, your passions, your skills to help other people in your hometown or throughout the world. So if you've got a hobby, if you've got a passion, if you've got a skill, most people don't think that that's something that they can participate in sharing with somebody that's going to help them. And I would venture to guess, if you took most people and you sat them down and said, is there something specific that you do that you know that that is more than anybody else, you'll probably find that something, that particular skill, hobby, whatever, that they can have, that they can share with somebody that could really do some good across the world. And especially today, you're right, the webcam. My goodness, what you sit there with a webcam and you can be talking to somebody 1,000 to 2,000 miles away, and it's like they're right across the desk from you.
Exactly. And I love that you brought that up about hobbies and passions, because I totally agree with you. When people think about volunteering and charity work, they think sometimes of tedious, arduous tasks, and sometimes there are those tasks that need to be done. But what I encourage people to do is to look first at what you love. It reminds me of one of my very, very favorite quotes. And it says, do not ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive. And then go and do that. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. So it's a perfect illustration of...
No, go ahead.
The difference. Yeah, the difference you can make when you use your passions. And guess what? You're going to stay involved longer. You're going to give more time because you're doing an activity that you love.
There's another side of this that, as you're speaking, I'm thinking about also. There's a tremendous amount of people that you know, they go to work, they do whatever they do, and they live their life day after day after day after day, and they don't have a legacy. It would be very interesting, quote-unquote, changing the world on a Tuesday night, to be able to work with people, touch people globally that really need what you have to offer. And then when you're gone, your legacy does live on.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, I really believe that that's something that most people are missing. And this is an interesting way to accomplish and fulfill that need or that want within them. Because again, you know, when you give, you get 10 times more than what it is, because that emotional satisfaction, that fill up that you experience by giving something to somebody who couldn't get what you have unless you were there to do it.
Exactly. And you were just reminded me of, you know, many stories of people that I interviewed for my book where they actually set out looking for volunteer opportunities that did fulfill a need or a desire within them. So some people look for something using their hobbies or passions and or look for something that fulfills a desire. There's a woman I interviewed who's a big sister with Big Brothers Big Sisters. She was married for 9 years. She expected to start a family with her husband. When the marriage fell apart, she found herself single, not a parent, and had no idea when she may have the opportunity to become a parent. But she wanted mostly to make an impact in the life of a young person. So that's what inspired her to get involved with Big Brothers Big Sisters. There's another woman who is a 911 operator. She's been doing that for 20 years. And as she takes calls every day, she realizes that she's hearing the beginning of stories, many of which do not have a happy ending. She used to ask how the calls ended, and then she discovered quickly that many of them don't end well. And she was just getting, you know, kind of sad and depressed, and she just wanted to be involved with something where she knew there was a happy ending. So now she volunteers doing plant therapy. So they work with plants and gardening, and she works with brain injury patients. So many of them were really at the end of their lives, and she's creating happy endings and happy little moments that she just participates in each time she walks into that facility. Those are people that, you know, saw something missing in their life, as you mentioned, and they went looking specifically for that thing, and of course are finding tremendous fulfillment.
You know, I just learned something tonight, and then thank goodness that the world is full of learning. When you stop learning, you might as well give it all up. Websites mm-hmm. for websites for volunteering so you can contribute. Who'd have thunk? No, it's great.
Yes. Absolutely. So I compiled them because there are so many great ones. I compiled them all on my website in a resources page that people can access and go just explore lots of different opportunities.
Now, by the way, one of the things that I know you address, and then we should get an answer to this, why you should think twice before calling the local soup kitchen to volunteer this, Thanksgiving's over with, but why would you think twice about that?
And the holidays in particular, Thanksgiving and Christmas. It's very interesting, but in my research for this book and interactions with nonprofits, I discovered something that I wasn't actually aware of. And that is, during the holiday season, for whatever reason, our culture puts an emphasis on generosity and giving back more in this season than in any other time of the year. So it has individuals and families seek out opportunities to serve in their community, which is fantastic. They want to go to soup kitchens and shelters and participate with their family, which is wonderful. The challenge is lots of people inundate certain organizations during this holiday period. And what happens is it actually becomes an administrative burden for the nonprofit to manage the influx of inquiries. Now, the problem is they would never tell you that because they want to leave you with a great impression of their organization. They want to engage you so that perhaps you will engage later in the year, in the spring, in the summer, in the fall, when hardly anyone is calling. So it's a challenging situation for nonprofits, and you know, they're not going to shout this out to the world. So I like to share it with people and say, hey, if you do feel compelled to volunteer on the holidays, why don't you just make sure that when you call an organization, find out if they actually need help then. If they don't actually need the help then, find out perhaps when later in the year they could use the help more.
Well, you know, by the way, we're running out of time, but I want to thank you for coming on tonight. You really opened my eyes about things I haven't even thought about, which I think is great.
Great.
Mo, it was wonderful. Hey, Tammy, website we can find you at and get the book.
My website is www.onatuesdaynight.com. You can buy the book there, and when you do, you can select a nonprofit that $2 of the book sale will go to, so we do profit sharing. And as I mentioned, there's a resources page there, so you can find all sorts of websites like volunteer match and the Points of Light Institute, where you can put in your zip code and put in a keyword, perhaps a hobby of yours, and find volunteering opportunities right in your community.
Wonderful. Tammy DeVille, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Michael. Have a wonderful holiday season.
Okay, you too. Good night. Merry Christmas.
Bye-bye.
You may even miss me, baby, when I'm gone away. You're gonna feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, honey, you always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me, you know, yeah, you know it's gonna grieve me. Yeah, I'm gonna miss your bony little daddy, 'cause I wanna be. Said some of these days I do it so quick, you're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging, you're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm long. For you.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Jim Holtze with us. He's the author of The Power of Storytelling, Captivate, Convince, or Convert Any Business Audience Using Stories from Top CEOs. He's written for CEOs and other executives in the United States and Europe at Siemens, a public relations and corporate communications veteran with 20 years of experience in the United States and overseas. He's educated at Columbia University at New York University. Jim, hi. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. The power of a story. You know, we've heard people say time and again, tell a story, get the point across. But what's the dynamic? What actually occurs when an audience, and an audience can be one person or 10 million, what happens when somebody is told the story?
Well, I think a couple things happen. I think particularly in the business world, it's easier to understand a story than it is a whole series of facts and figures. It's not to say that facts and figures aren't important in business presentations. They are. But I think, in a way, we're all kind of hardwired for stories. Think about events that happen in our lives in the past. Eventually, they all end up becoming stories anyway. So when you're trying to get your point across at a business presentation, my recommendation is always, yes, it's good to have your facts and figures. After all, that is a part of business. But I think if you really want to motivate an audience and to really make your point, it really helps to tell a story. And the best stories are always your own.
Now, by the way, I have found with stories over the years, the most powerful thing with a story is that it brings everybody into the same frame of reference. They can actually visualize, see themselves within the story. As an example, if I were to say chamber around, most people would have no idea what that meant. They wouldn't have a visual image tied to the word. But if I said, well, when you chamber around, it's so-and-so who put a bullet in a gun. Now all of a sudden, you see the bullet. Yeah. It's that.
Exactly. I think, again, my belief is that we're hardwired for stories. That We identify with them. We can, and we remember them better. And, you know, one of the things I said in the introduction of the book was, I made a scenario, or actually two scenarios, of two companies that were in the same industry, the same town, and had pretty much the same results in a particular quarter. And the one CEO gets in front of the audience and drones on and on with a 42-page PowerPoint presentation that nobody really wants to listen to. The other CEO gets up in front, has three PowerPoint slides, but tells a story and puts the results of that particular quarter in context. And I think, you know, I asked the question rhetorically in the introduction, well, guess which CEO's presentation is going to be remembered that day, that a week after, or a year after? Obviously the one who tells a story. And I think we've all been in a position before where we've sat in the audience and we've listened. And if you just think back to any speech you heard, most likely, whether, again, it was a day ago, a week ago, or a year ago, more than likely you're going to remember the stories that you heard in the speech more than anything else.
Oh, sure, because the story becomes about me. And when I say about
right.
me, if I can recognize something, I think the best example is go to a movie. You've got trained and skilled actors and actresses on that screen. Part of
right.
that learned skill is knowing that what they say and what they do, most importantly, how they do it, is going to produce a very specific effect. It's planned
right.
and has an intentionally predetermined reaction. They're reading from a script. You know it's not real, but they're deliberately activating every emotion possible in you. You're crying, you're loved, you're frightened, you're angry, because in that moment, you're living the story. You recognize something that caused you to react. There was something familiar. They set up a predetermined reaction, and I think that's the same thing that happens with the story. Based on where you are, and the content and the delivery of the story is going to get the results you want.
Exactly, exactly. In fact, I have a friend who was a screenwriter out in California, and he's now working for a CEO at a corporation in Los Angeles. And he finds that a lot of the skills that he used in writing screenplays for Hollywood are actually very useful for working, working in that corporate environment out in Los Angeles. Why? Because it's a lot of storytelling.
Oh, well, by the way, we better be careful with what we say. It sounds like they're coming after you.
This is New York.
Yeah, I got it loud and clear. There's a dynamic that occurs when somebody hears a story when it's processed. They're very specialized brain cells that fire up when you see or you hear something you recognize, and then you imitate that action in your mind. And I really believe strongly that if somebody, like with the skill that you have, when you tell a story, the people that are listening to you actually become involved in it. And now it's not about a business or a CEO, even though they might be the example. It's about them. And they recognize
right,
themselves.
Right. And I think some of the better stories are ones where there's some sort of a conflict, an unresolved issue right up front.
Sure.
And then kind of if you go back to, say, Joseph Campbell and talking about, I forgot the name of his book, about heroes. You know, there's a conflict that has to be resolved. The hero goes through all kinds of trials and tribulations and eventually succeeds. And
yeah.
This is a common element in a lot of myths that's the name of the book, Power of Myth. This is a very common element in a lot of the myths that are found all over the world. And it's, again, part of storytelling. I think people identify, for example, with somebody who's given a difficult situation, and then works hard to overcome it, and then eventually does it. There's a dramatic tension that's created at the beginning and then ends up being relieved at the end. And again, my belief is that there's no reason why this can't be brought up in a business context, because there's a lot of conflict in business, and there's a lot of effort to try to solve problems and whatnot. And when they do work out well, I think that they're great examples for others to learn by.
Oh, absolutely. And you call it, well, they say it a different way. It's problem, solution. You
exactly.
get your ideal audience and you bring up the problem that you know they have, follow it with the solution that you have to offer in the context of a story.
Exactly. Exactly. And it's the example that you give that people say, gee, for example, if that person solved that sales problem, or if that person overcame that particular bit of adversity, I can do the same. It's like you said before, people will personally identify with it. Even though they didn't take part in the story, they can see themselves almost as if they were an actor in it as well. And they say,
absolutely.
Well, if that person could do it, so can I.
No, we mirror things. There was that old thing about if you're in a bad mood and you see a smiley face, you'll start smiling yourself. We imitate things, and we automatically, right. You know, it's brain science. We don't have to get into it. But we automatically see things. We hear a story that is going to help us. It's a little shot of dopamine from the brain. We feel good about what we heard, and then we take action because it's about us. And if it's not about me, I'm not going to listen to you.
Right, right. And that's the thing. I think most people, particularly in a business presentation, will tend to tune out if they're bombarded with too many numbers, too many facts and figures. And again, I'm not trying to say that numbers and facts and figures aren't important in business presentations. They most definitely are. But the way most business presentations are made today, it's almost overwhelmingly, and you talked about neuroscience before, it's overwhelmingly left brain. It's overwhelmingly analytical. What I'm saying is you need to have a little bit of the left brain and the right brain, so both the analytical side and the more creative, think-out-of-the-box side as well. And again, most business presentations tend to be almost exclusively left-brained at the expense of the right. And my book is trying to talk a little bit more about, hey, why don't you open up a little bit more of the right brain thinking here, because that's actually what people listen to and remember.
Oh, absolutely. And when it comes down to it, it's the proverbial the so what and the what's in it for me. They've got to recognize a perceived value in what you're saying.
And you know, in the introduction I brought up, you know, when you go back, when you work for a large company, for example, and you listen to your CEO go through a speech on whatever topic, and you know, you go back to your desk or your cubicle or your office or whatever, 9 times out of 10 when you talk with colleagues, what they'll remember is, oh, do you remember when Bob talked about visiting such and such a client, or when he mentioned where he took his family on vacation and how he saw our product there, or something like that. There's a sort of tactile feel to that people will immediately identify with. I can almost guarantee you that when they go back to their desks and whatnot, nobody's going to say, yeah, hey, you know, wow, our R&D spend went up 4.7%. Isn't that terrific? That may be important, but nobody will remember that. And the CEO, in many ways, is getting people to act on his or her words by using an effective story.
Yeah, and by the way, I think the entire key here is very simple. It brings it down to it, is you have to tie your message to a recognizable image. Then you've got 100% of the audience that knows exactly what you meant by what you said, as opposed to what they think you meant by what they heard. And that, I think, is about an 80% killer of any audience out there if they don't understand or they don't relate, quote-unquote, to what it is that the speaker is saying. It's going to go right over their head.
Right, and their attention tends to drift. They'll look at the exits. They'll start wondering, when can I get out of here? They'll check their emails and their BlackBerry and whatnot, and you've lost them by then.
Now, absolutely. There's no question about it. And what I have found over the years, and I've done tons of interviews over the years, I mean, literally a lot. And what I have found with the majority of authors, whether it's fact, fun, fiction, fantasy, whatever it is, if you get right down to the core of it, it's about them. And it's an external expression of who and what they are and what they've worked on themselves. And when you start to listen to somebody else's story and you resonate with what it is that they went through, back to problem solution, resonate with what it is that they went through, and all of a sudden you've got that emotional platform that everybody's on the same playing field and you all move forward.
Exactly, because there is that connection. And there's not necessarily that connection through a pure left-brain analytical deductive reasoning approach. People don't connect to that.
No, not at all. Because when they talk about there's got to be emotions in the story, there's got to be feelings, but there's an internal dynamic that occurs that most people have no idea what it is that goes on, the mechanics of what goes on when somebody tells a story and it's heard from the other end.
And I brought up in the book as well. I think the world of politics seems to be better at storytelling than the world of business, and that may be because they're very different types of professions. But it seems to me that politicians are just better polished when it comes to storytelling. For example, I remember I was much younger back then, but I remember Ronald Reagan's first inaugural address, and he talked about American heroism by bringing up an example of somebody who had pulled. a victim of an airline crash that had happened actually a day or two before that speech was delivered. And sure, he talked about his plans for the budget and his plans for this, that, and the other thing in government. But the one thing that people remembered was that story, right? And Reagan was a great storyteller. I think Franklin Roosevelt was a great storyteller as well.
Sure, and now, by the way,
level that people could identify with. Sure. But again, business people tend to shy away from that. Maybe it's because they don't want to necessarily take on the mantle that politicians take on, or maybe they feel it's too soft, it's too mushy, it's too creative for them, whatever. But I think they're making a big mistake by not tapping into that, because they can really motivate people to act on their words better by using narrative.
No, absolutely. Let me give you an example of exactly what you're saying with a politician. Like him,
sure.
Dislike him. It has nothing to do with politics right now. Barack Obama.
Mm-hmm.
With what he did, let's look at how he does something. He'll pause, and the pause is an unconscious alert something's coming. Then he'll make
right.
a left-brain literal statement, healthcare is in shambles. He will pause again. That pause after the left-brain statement allows the audience to absorb what just got said. And then he goes into a rhetorical right-brain story. Sam
right.
from Texas lost his job, lost his health care, and now he has to go to the hospital with his kids and doesn't have any money. Now, all of a sudden, you got problem-solution. You've got it structured in such a way. He's balanced it, and he's got both sides of the brain involved, and he's got his point across.
No, exactly, and I think President Obama is also a very good storyteller. I remember some of the speeches he gave during the 2008 campaign, in particular the one he gave on race, and I believe it was in Philadelphia. In one, if I remember correctly, he wrote that, not his own speechwriters. Again, you know, balancing the facts with the story can be very effective, very very effective. Also, in his books, I've read both of his books as well, and he does a very good job. Job there as well. The irony is that so many of the business leaders that I profiled in my book actually do a good job in storytelling in their books, but not every CEO does that necessarily in their speeches.
You know, and by the way, the interesting point, the difference between being live and also being on the air. There was somebody on the show, where we won't mention his name, but this man is really tall. He walks into a room and he captures a room. I mean, there he is, and they walk out and they love him, and everything is fine, and he makes millions and tens of millions of dollars of whatever what he does. But then he got on the air, and it was an entirely different thing. There weren't the stories. There weren't the calls to action. There weren't all the things that he does on a personal level. So realistically, if you do it, you've got the process and you've got the strategy, do it all the time. And I think the power of storytelling, your book, Captivate, Convince, or Convert Any Business Audience Using Stories from the Top 10 CEOs, it's brilliant because that's what it does. When push comes to shove, that's where the sell is. We live in a world you can't sell anything to anybody anymore. It doesn't work. But if the proper story is told, they will convince themselves, they'll sell themselves. The sell
right.
is in the story.
Right, right, exactly. And one of the things I wanted to do with the book, I mean, basically, and I say it very clearly in the beginning, you know, the best stories are the ones you can tell yourself, right, obviously, because you're a protagonist in your own stories, or you have an involvement with it. But sometimes, sometimes you don't have your own stories to tell. So what I did in writing the book was I went through as many business autobiographies as I could find, and I picked out the best stories from them and then told them in basically my own words, and then had a section underneath saying how you can use that in your own writing. Now, you could use that in your own speeches or presentations. It could be in front of 10,000 people, 100 people, or 12, or a pep talk in front of your direct reports, whatever.
Sure.
You can use the stories from other CEOs, but what I also hope the book will accomplish is not just to borrow from other CEOs, but in reading it, I hope it kind of triggers a memory on the part of the reader to say, oh yeah, that reminds me of something that happened in my own life, and then they then tell that story to their next audience. So in a way, I'm just kind of hoping that the book is, a catalyst for creativity, right? to get people to get into the mode of storytelling of their own. And if they're completely stumped, have nothing to add, then they could paraphrase what they learned from these other CEOs and use it. But in some form or fashion, to try to get more people to try telling stories again.
Sure, and if it's not a story, it's an anecdote. It could be 10 or 15 seconds, or you can stretch it out to 2 or 3 minutes, depending upon where you are. Jim, we're starting to run out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at?
I have a blog site, and I'm sorry, I don't have the address in front of me. I'm not very active on it, but they can, folks can look up the book on Amazon.com. I do have an author page on Amazon.com as well, so you can learn more about my background, and there are various bits of... I have a Facebook page on the book itself, on the writing of it, if they want to learn more about that. And all they have to do is just go on Facebook and type in my name, James, H-O-L-T-J-E, and you can learn more about how the book itself was put together.
Dynamite. Hey, thank you so much for joining us, Jim.
Terrific. I had a great time. Thank you very much, Michael.
Take care. Good night.
Night. Bye-bye.
Hello, young lovers, whoever you are. I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own. Ah.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. That's, what is it? Where are we?
Dresser After Dark.
Every once, we get older, sometimes you forget. Clint Arthur with us. He is the author of The Last Year of Your Life, A Personal Transformation Experience. Clint Arthur's 52-week time-tested program inspires clients to make huge things happen in their lives. He's appeared in hundreds of TV radio shows, including Fox, CBS, ABC affiliates, and The Iron Chef of America. And let us say, Clint, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure to be here.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. I have always felt, for years and years and years now, I have always felt that if you knew at midnight tonight it was over with, how different would your life be? How different would the decisions that you would make be? Also, what about the things that bother you, that pressure you, that stress you? All of a sudden, they wouldn't have any power, would they?
Yeah, well, that's a great point. If you knew it was tonight, but think about this. What if you knew this was the last 30 seconds of your life? What would you do?
Probably have a good, strong cup of coffee and say, next.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah. These questions are so interesting. What happened to me was I graduated from the Wharton Business School, same school as Donald Trump. And after that, I moved out to Los Angeles to pursue my dreams of becoming a filmmaker and a movie star like my idol, Spike Lee. And after banging my head into the brick wall of the Hollywood dream for over a decade, it came to be New Year's Eve on the millennium. Now, where were you on New Year's Eve of the millennium? Were you out having fun, partying with friends and family, maybe? Well, I was driving a taxi that night.
I don't even remember.
I was driving a taxi that night.
Uh-huh.
And when it was all over, I went home to my little boat in Marina Del Rey. It was the cheapest way I could live in Los Angeles. It was $282 a month.
Yeah.
And I had made $513 that night, which was my normal weekly salary in those days. And I crawled into bed with all my heaviest clothes on under my down comforter, and because there was no heat on the boat, of course. And I pulled out my favorite book to start reading to try and calm down after that exciting night. And as I'm laying there with the flashlight reading my book, Angela's Ashes by Frank McCourt, I got distracted by the sight of my breath condensing in the cold night air. And I started thinking back on my journey about how I had studied creative writing with the man whose book was in my hands, Frank McCourt. He had just won the Pulitzer Prize for Angela's Ashes, the greatest living writer of our time. And then I graduated from the same school as Donald Trump, and my fraternity brothers had gone on to become directors at Goldman Sachs Corporation. And here I was scraping by on $500 a week, and I started crying because I was terrified that I was never going to be able to turn my life around. But that night I swore that I was going to do something. I was going to change who I was so that I could also change what was showing up in my life. And I started doing all kinds of self-help. I did fire walking with Tony Robbins himself standing right next to me. I did Deepak Chopra. I did Toltec Wisdom Studies with Don Miguel Ruiz. I did men's power circles, everything you could imagine. And slowly my life began to change. I started selling gourmet food instead of driving taxis. I got married to a wonderful woman. I started building houses after that. I built 5 houses during the real estate boom. And indeed, my life did change as I changed who I was. And I became literally fat and happy. You know what I'm saying, Michael?
Yeah, sure.
Unfortunately, I was obese. I became 236 pounds at my highest point. And if you think about how I wrestled in high school at 145, you can understand the magnitude of the change. And perhaps grasp how unhappy and unhealthy I was, and especially because I had given up writing. I'd been writing my whole life, and in order to change, I said, forget the Hollywood dream. Writing is not going to do anything for me except put me behind the wheel of a cab. And so I was unfulfilled, and I was unhealthy, and after 7 years, my marriage was on the rocks, and then one night I was in a men's self-help circle, and a man said to me, "You don't even know it yet, boy, but you are already dead." And I couldn't stop thinking about that, but I didn't understand what it meant. And then it came to be New Year's Day, and I poured myself a mimosa, and I sat down to write my list of goals for the year. And I said, hey, what would I want to do this year if this was going to be the last year of my life?
Yeah.
And that's what changed everything.
Yeah, no question about it. And as a matter of fact, I really believe, and I've said it a couple times on the air, that for a lot of people, if you just don't know what you want out of life, project ahead 15, 20, 25 years, to a party they're having in your honor, people that you love, people that you like, and all the things you would like them to say about you, and you write them all down, and now you got 15 or 20 years to create that.
Oh, that's very nice. I like that concept.
Yeah, but I truly believe it, and it's going to be very interesting. December 21st, 2012. Also, it's an interesting time because that's right after the next election. This is going to be a very interesting world that we have in a year. And by the way, you know, you're absolutely right. In this next year, until next December, this world as we know it is going to change tremendously. And I don't necessarily mean that it's going to be, you know, the prophecies and the world's going to come to an end and whatever. But I really think that in this next year, we're going to see some drastic changes that we never even thought. I grew up in a world that was nothing like this. And I'm from the Los Angeles area. And I grew up in a world that what we go through today, politically, culturally, what's accepted, not accepted, didn't exist. And I think it's just about ready to come to a head. And I really believe that a year from now, we're going to know it.
We are going to know it. It's inevitable. I mean, there's so much going on right now, and you know, you're talking about the Mayan calendar. 5,000 years ago plus, yes, the Mayans charted the heavens to come up with their calendar. And of all the things that they could have etched in stone the way they did, they etched a 5,000-year calendar in their stone, and that calendar is coming to an end on December 21st, 2012. So we are about to begin the last year of the Mayan calendar, and who knows what's going to happen. We don't know if the world is going to come to an end, or we don't know if this is just the Mayans presaging an age of enlightenment or a transformation into a new age of enlightenment for the human race. That's personally what I think is going to be happening. I think that people are going to wake up to the fact that life is more precious than we've been treating it. And they're going to wake up to the fact that the relationships with the people who are in our lives are much more valuable and precious than the way we've been holding them. And they're going to wake up to the fact that we need to be nicer to ourselves and kinder and gentler to each other. And we need to be more compassionate towards ourselves. And we also need to be more ambitious and hold ourselves to a higher standard of excellence and really demand that we bring out what is truly special about each of us. Like that you and I each have to look in the mirror every day and say, how can I make this day really, really count? What can I do to help the world and help myself and help my ancestors and help humanity with my actions today?
One of the indicators
that the Mayans are talking about.
Sure, but Clint, one of the indicators that something like this will happen is take a look at the confusion that's going on in this country and in the world. It's not just here. The confusion that's going on, nobody has any certainty anymore. Nobody can say this is what's going to happen. Nobody can say the economy is going to get better or we're going to have enough jobs to go around. I mean, the list goes on and on. People are running around in fear. That's an indicator that something's going to happen within the next year, because it can only go to a certain point before it quote unquote explodes. And when I say explodes, I don't mean people are going to pick up guns and shoot each other, but look at somebody who's an alcoholic or somebody who has a drug problem. They have to go all the way to the bottom when there's nowhere else to go before they fall apart and then they rebuild themselves again. And I think that in and of itself is a prime example of what's going on today. And you better be ready, because if you are not ready, if you are not emotionally, spiritually, and physically ready, you're not going to make it beyond 2012, December.
I have to agree with you, Michael. I mean, the world is obviously coming to the bursting point, and it's all, and it's, and you're not going to expect it. It's not like they're going to put up a flag and say, okay, guys, get ready for the big change. It doesn't happen like that. All of a sudden, you wake up one day and the Twin Towers are crumbling on the morning news live in front of your very eyes. And nothing is ever the same after that. And we're coming up on another one of those moments, and it's going to happen in 2012.
Well, absolutely. And I really, totally, and completely believe that. And I think one of the ways to prep for that is not go get ammunition. Ways to prep for that is get yourself emotionally and physically sound, being able to deal with it. And you said it earlier when they said you're not alive. It's time for people to come alive. 90% of the people out there are walking around. They're upright and they're dead. They don't have a life anymore. Just getting up and going to work and doing whatever does not mean that you're alive. And I think that in and of itself is a very powerful statement. It's time to wake up. And I think that's really what you could call this, an awakening.
Well, that's why I've come up with this five-step process on how to come alive. And the first step is A, awareness. You need to become aware of the problem before you can fix the problem. And the problem is that you're walking around like a zombie, or not 100% committed or engaged in your life, or not 100% committed to the relationships and the love in your life and to your own health. And once you become aware of that, you can move on to the next step. And hopefully, hearing my voice right now saying, you don't know it yet, but you're already dead. I hope the listener, whoever you are, wherever you are now aware of the problem, because I just made you aware of it. Next is L, let go of the past. If you're like me, you're probably going to want to beat yourself up over the years that you've wasted not being fully engaged, not being fully alive, not taking care of your body, dumbing yourself down with drugs and prescription drugs and alcohol and overeating and not being in shape. But beating yourself up isn't going to help you. You got to let go of the loss. You just got to cut your losses and move on to the next step, which is I, inspire yourself with goals and ambitions and dreams that will make you jump out of bed in the morning because you're so excited to get going in your life and be involved in the things that you've got planned and in the process of making your dreams come true. And then that takes us naturally to the next step, which is V, visualize. how to make your dreams come true. Once you have the dream, the next step is to visualize how to put the pieces together to get you from where you are now to where you want to go, from having a dream to having a reality. And you're the only person who can figure that out for yourself. If If you want to have your dream home, you've got to visualize how to make that dream home become your reality home. And then lastly, the next step is energize. You need energy for the voyage of making your dreams come true. And that it's three-dimensional energy. You need physical energy, which comes from good nutrition, exercise, and enough rest and sleep. That's very important. Then you need good mental energy. You need to be reading quotes that are inspirational, and you need to have positive people in your life who are sharing your dreams and telling you that you can do it instead of dragging you down and saying you can't do it. And then you need the third dimension, which is spiritual energy, and that comes from being connected to your soul, and that comes from being out in nature or being involved in your religious pursuits. Whatever needs your soul has in order to make it feel fulfilled, you need that energy as well. And when you have ALIVE, then you can come alive.
It's recognizing, and I'm listening to everything you're saying, but it's also recognizing yourself. I heard somebody say something, or no, it was written within the last week. I can't remember who it was that said it, but I looked at it and I had to back up and take a second look at it. It said, we got it backwards. See, most people think it's humans living, trying to live a spiritual life, but it's really spirit living a human life. And there's where I think the confusion is.
Oh, you're absolutely right. The spiritual beings that we all are, the spirit lives on forever without the body, but it's having a tough time adapting to the constraints of our little human existence here on this little spinning rock out in the middle of the universe.
Yeah.
That's
and there's
a tough
so
part,
many,
but
so more out there. I think they found another spinning rock just like we are. They found another Earth. Yeah, but it's like 600 light years away. And by the time you flew there, you'd be dead anyway. So, but they found another Earth out there. There is so much out there. And we've only got a couple minutes to go, but let me end this with this. We go through life and we define things. And I think there's where the problem is. If you go beyond what you see, beyond the stars, beyond space, beyond all of it, it doesn't end. But how can it not end? See, that's where the scary part is. We live with this linear mind that can't grasp there's something beyond it, but then how can it end anywhere? So in essence, we're dealing with the undefinable. And when people try to define the undefinable and they come up with a definition for something that they have no idea about, they get into trouble, and you know they have no idea what they're talking about. So when you start to define something that's undefinable, you have to stand back and just say, just allow it to be. Otherwise, you're going to be in big trouble here because you're limited.
I think that you're right, and I think that the human experience is undefinable. But I do believe that we as human beings can explore our own potential. And that's why I designed and have perfected the Last Year of Your Life experience, which people can find out about at www.lastyearofyourlife.com, which is a 52-week personal exploration program, because you cannot define it, but you can explore it. You can set out to discover what are the limits of your own self as a human being. And the way you do that is by studying how you perform in different challenges and while examining different topics like loving yourself and having compassion for yourself and others, and being a great leader, and being a great speaker, and being healthy, and all the different topics that you'll find out about at lastyearofyourlife.com. Because you're absolutely right, Michael. It is an exploration, and you cannot define the human experience.
Hey, by the way, I want to go back to, we're running out of time now, Clint, but I want to go back to taxi cabs. It must have been about 6 or 7 years ago. Maybe 4 or 5 years ago. I had to go to Los Angeles to do some kind of speaking in the marina, by the way. I was going to Burbank. I got out of LA airport and I got into a cab, and it was scary because it was this bulletproof shield up there, and it was like in a cage back there. And I thought, man, is this what we come to?
Well, they're ex-police cars that they convert into taxis, and those cages are the police back seat.
Yeah. Unbelievable.
That's how taxi cabs get created.
By the way, we got to go, but I want to thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate the work that you're doing, so go out and get them.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate the opportunity to share this life's calling mission with your people.
Thanks. Take care. Good night, Clint.
Good night.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call, and the only heart I own for you and you alone. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Gail Feldman with us, Dr. Gail Feldman, PhD. She's the author of Midlife Crash Course, The Journey from Crisis to Full Creative Power. She served 22 years as clinical assistant professor in the psychiatry department of the University of New Mexico School of Medicine. She's a longtime resident of Albuquerque, divides her time between Albuquerque and San Diego, California, where she was born and raised. This is her sixth book, and let us say, Gail, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. By the way, can you hear me? Am I breaking up at all?
You're not really loud, but I can hear you, yes.
How about that? Is that better?
Yes.
Okay. And Seth, I know you're on the board. If you could just amp us up a little bit, we would be in great shape. 10 things readers will discover within the book. You talk about responses to physical illness, injury, broken heart, lost relationships. When we really come down to it, when we have these things occur, Gail, if you've got yourself tuned in into the right direction, and it's not easy to go through at the time, but so many of these things are gifts because they allow you to open up and really live a fuller life.
They really do. And again, as you say, when you're in the middle of it, when you're in what's sometimes called the transformational fire, it's a tough thing to try to begin to see the opportunities that are going to come. But I really feel that midlife is all about rebirth and renewal. And okay. The crises that feel like they're kind of taking us down at that time, they're really honing us and helping us to begin to recreate ourselves and our lives.
Now, by the way, no matter how much education we have, how much experience we think we have, and how much we work with people, it's all well and good until it happens to us. And then the big shock comes, and it's very confusing when you get to that point of you know everything, and at the same time, you know nothing. Where was it that you got hit with this?
Oh, my God. It was really after ending a 35-year marriage and then having a skiing accident with broken bones and a head injury. So I had a broken heart, a broken bones, and a broken head with no assurance that I would recover. And the idea of being impaired, you know, going from being the person who was always there to help others to being the person who couldn't even drive, couldn't read, couldn't watch TV, couldn't tolerate sounds, couldn't work at the computer. Being that impaired and without knowing if I would recover, it's like you lose your sense of identity, your sense of being worthwhile. And the grief that one goes into is very, very deep.
Now, by the way, one of the things that, you know, that you do talk about is, and people think that they get certain experiences as they grow, et cetera. It's not always that way. But the new midlife, you know, 30 years in, you know, our 40s or 50s or 60s, old age isn't considered to be there until your 80s and older now. The age does not, the reason I'm saying that is age does not prepare you for what you're talking about that you went through. You could have been 70 years old and gone through it, and it would have been the same response if you didn't have the experience to move through it. What was it that triggered you? What caused you to be able to have that resilience to move through the problems and to come out of it the way you are?
Well, you know, I think that most people do have that resilience. And you mentioned the new midlife. You know, most people are shocked when they hear this because we grew up with our parents having a midlife that was 10 years in your 50s, you know, one decade. And now we get 30 years. We get our 40s and our 50s and our 60s. And people are shocked until they stop and think, oh, that's right, yeah, yeah. And the different kinds of crises that can happen at that time are just innumerable, but for many women especially, we find ourselves caring for four different generations. We have aging parents, we have children, we have grandchildren, and then we may have a partner or ourselves beginning to look after chronic illness, injury, or some other problem like that. And I really believe that all of us are on this hero's journey. And by the way, I learned that hero is a genderless word. I love that. It comes from the word Hera, and Hera was the name of Zeus's wife in Greek mythology. So it's a genderless word. We're all on our hero's journey, and it's all about learning resilience.
You see, I think the biggest problem that most of us have is the movies, the stories, the whatever, you know, the hero is the person that can take on 50 guys at one time and leap over tall buildings with a single bound. That's not a hero. That the hero is the person who moves forward under any condition. All of those things that you get put up against that you think that that they're insurmountable. The hero is the person who moves through it. And I believe with what you're saying, it's genderless, you know, because when you come right down to it, the common bond you and I have is we're human beings.
Yes, yes. And we will all suffer in certain ways. I don't believe that suffering is optional. I think suffering is inevitable, but it's misery that's optional. So I absolutely believe what you're saying. The ability to persevere, the ability to keep going, the ability even on my worst days to find faith that I'd get through that. That was really, really important for me.
Yeah, and by the way, it's not, when I say moving with it, it's not necessarily giving up, but it's moving with it. 14, 15 years ago, we'll go into the whole thing. I had a debilitating thing that happened to me, and I had to have an operation. I remember I was sitting there on my stationary bike because I thought, well, I'm going to get in the best condition I can to have an operation. I'll fix them, right? And then I got in the middle of it. I'm sweating, and I'm really doing a whatever, and then it hit me. I made it okay to die. Did not say I wanted to die, but I made it okay. The minute that I stopped resisting, the pressure got taken off, the stress got taken off, and I think my immune system kicked in and we're here talking today. So it's the resistance that causes a lot of the problem.
Absolutely, and it's the resistance that we find ourselves in those early stages of grief, of the anger and the resentment about what's happening and the obsessional stuff that we find ourselves doing during that grief process. But you know, when you hit bottom, when you finally just however that looks like for you, for me it was just I don't think I could have gotten any more depressed. And what we discover on the hero's journey is there definitely is that shift. There's always supernatural aid along the way. I had a divine visitation at one point when I I was trying to meditate one morning, and my brain just wouldn't go there. It just wouldn't do anything. So instead of just giving up and crying, I shouted this angry prayer, you know, like I was talking to God, you know, like, what's going on here? And I had this very gentle, loving visitation, and it basically teaching me to breathe, because one of the problems is I also could not breathe properly. And that was a turning point. And there were other kind of supernatural visitations from animals. And so one of the things when you're in that place that sometimes is called the belly of the whale, you know, when you're in that darkest, deepest place, and by the way, part of what we have to do in midlife and during this time is to learn to be with those lower emotions, learn to be with the depression, the weakness, that feeling that you can't go on, because that marks the turning point. There will be signs and wonders. There will be help along the way. I ended up with a snake in my bedroom one morning, and it was definitely a message of, well, you know what snakes represent. They represent, and I realized that the snake was there to help me know that I was shedding my old skin. I was shedding my identity, my former identity of having to be a certain way, of needing to always be, quote, perfect in certain ways, of being able to help others, and learning to be a number of other ways, softer ways in the world.
And then, by the way, when you shed it, when the mask came off, the facades came off, it wasn't a different identity. It was who you really were, or who you really are.
Oh, I'm so glad you're saying that, Michael. Yes, because we're talking about authenticity. We get so caught up, and of course we have to developmentally learn to have identities that serve us out in the world, but we get caught up in thinking that's who we are. And one of the wonderful things that happens to us during life crises and coming through the midlife hero's journey is that we emerge, as you're saying, with who we truly are. It's the fullness of who we truly are.
See, because when it comes down to it, if you take the word, by the way, am I echoing on you? Or can you hear me okay?
I can't. Yes, it's just a tiny echo.
If you take the definition of perfection, go to the dictionary, and what it says is the highest form of function. Well, perfection is a very interesting thing, because if I'm trying my hardest to be you, to be who you think that I should be, then I am never going to be perfect, because I can only be the second best you. And that's
right.
I think most people have a problem. I'm trying to be you, and I forget all about me, because I want to make sure that I'm who I think you want me to be.
Right. And you know, one of the things that I write about in the book, in fact, the last chapter is called Supremely Supportive Self-Care for the Journey. But there's a lot of positive psychology or resilient psychology in this book. And I think it's so needed right now. And the shift I trained, you know, I had a psychoanalytic training and so on. But one of the criticisms of psychology has been a rather relentless focus on what's wrong with people, on pathology. And what I love about the rather new positive psychology is we're looking at strength. We're emphasizing, what is right about me? What is truly authentic about me? Not how should I be for other people?
You know, I learned a word years ago. And the word that I learned was this. I took positive and threw it out the window. And I exchanged it with a word called appropriate. You're going to have positive thought all day long, and it doesn't do anything. It sits. It's neutral. But appropriate thought is taking action. And I think that in and of itself is where the power is. Most people don't. I'm thinking positive. Well, so what? You're still stuck in the same hole. But appropriate is grab a ladder and, you know, and get yourself out. And I really believe it's appropriate thought that get people to where they need to be. And it's simple, common sense logic, and it's getting rid of the shoulda, couldas, and wouldas. And I got to tell you what, I am so glad I'm as old as I am, because I get to know what I know now. And I don't know if I could exist as a 20, 30-year-old today.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, one of the things that I also share about my own personal journey in this story, as well as teaching it to other people, and that's self-coaching. That when we get caught up in the shoulds and the coulds and so on, we're really going down a road that doesn't lead us anywhere. But if we can come back to what Martin Seligman taught at the University of Pennsylvania as the ABCs of self-coaching, then you can kind of go through, okay, what is the event? What is the adverse experience here, the A? And you just look at it. And the B is, what's my belief about it? And, of course, we come up with all kinds of crazy interpretations of what's in life. And then we have to look at C. What is the consequence of interpreting that way?
We should tell her that and reschedule her. Okay.
Right.
Yeah, I'm right here. Everything's good.
Back.
Oh, good. I missed you.
I'm back.
I know. I missed.
I was talking, Michael, about the importance of self-coaching, the power of being able to redirect your thinking.
By the way, isn't that what it's about? Isn't it a let's use a different word. Isn't it a shift in thinking?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
And I think a prime example of that is if you and I were in a room together, we're standing there together, and you're standing with your very stiff, and you've got your legs together, you've got your feet together, you've got your hands down at your side, you're very stiff, and I take a certain amount of power and I push you on the chest, and you're going to fall backwards.
Mm-hmm,
but then if you move your legs apart and you get your balance and you're okay, and I push you with the same amount of force, you keep your balance. So in essence, what happens is the same thing happened, but it was entirely different because you shifted. And I think if you shift the way we think, the world is completely different.
Exactly. Yeah. And so it's about looking at these experiences in midlife as challenges that they are, and then recognizing the opportunities for change, for growing in new directions, for service. You know, what does everybody say when they come through a really, really difficult, even a life-changing experience? What they value the most is love.
Yeah.
It's like you have a strengthened connection with those people you love in your life. And there's also more of an emphasis on service. You know, Einstein said that the ideal of success should be replaced with the ideal of service. Only a life lived for others is a life worthwhile.
Yeah.
And Mother Teresa said love in action is service. So
yeah,
that's part of the renewal that comes at the end of this hero's journey. It's finding the treasure, and the treasure is always about wisdom. And it's coming back to share the gift.
No question. We're starting to run out of time now. Website we can find you at and buy the book.
MidlifeCrashCourse.com.
Wonderful. Okay, midlifecrashcourse.com. Hey, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I've appreciated your time. Great story, and realistically, the core message is that, you know, the worse it gets, the better it is.
Absolutely, because you're going to find a renewed life purpose, and you're going to learn to embrace the adventure.
Wonderful. Okay, good night, and thank you so much again for being here.
Good night, Michael. Thank you.
Good night.
We've shared a moment, and as the moment ends, I got a funny feeling. We're parting out as friends.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser.
And I'm Radio Susie.
And that, my friends, is
a wrap.
We'll linger after they've torn down these dusty walls. If I had this to do again, and the evening were new again, I would spend it with you again.
PBSRadio.com.